Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
We invite people of all backgrounds to share their stories.
Through nuanced conversations
and forward thinking
and not taking ourselves too seriously.
Everyone's story matters.
Every voice is important.
Life is polarizing.
But not everything is black and white.
Come join us
as we fade to gray.
Where are you coming, Seth?
Hey, everyone.
Hey,
I am so pleased to announce about it. A series that we are doing on reparative therapy. And as many of our listeners know, I have my own story around reparative therapy. And so this means a lot to me. And we are going to be speaking with a guest today by the name of Randy Thomas, who I am getting this interview with feels like a big deal to me. I don't know if it's a big deal. Okay,
it's like some closure
is the former vice president of Exodus International and now runs an organization called Thrive Plus.
He's the executive director.
Well,
yeah, we don't even know what that is.
I think it's going to apply to reparative therapy. perhaps we can get into that in this conversation today.
Okay. I didn't mean to jump the gun there.
But
what's he doing now?
Let's first talk to, he's the executive director of Thrive Plus, but let's let the man speak for himself. Randy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I love your introduction. I feel like a big deal now.
You're pretty important if you didn't know that, Randy. I'm glad to have
you. Yeah, we're stoked to have you.
Thank you.
We really
are
so
glad to be here.
Privileged.
Yeah.
Seth has been, talking about this interview ever since he set it up, and he's just been so nervous to speak with you. And, we've all been looking forward to it as well. So, what we like to do, Randy, is just kind of start out at the very basics. You know, we are a post deconstruction podcast. We talk to people about, their process of going through religion and how that started. So what does that look like for you?
Well, it's of course ongoing. You don't get into a cult forever 2 decades and not have a lot to unprocess or deconstruct.
Certainly.
And so it's ongoing. And, you know, for me, it really started, years before I even came out the second time. I used to be out in the 80s, and then I went into the church closet in 1992, got involved in the ex-gay conversion therapy movement at the time, and really around 2008, 2011, I started seeing kind of what your former guest Brandon Robertson saw, in that I was seeing the people around me, the people that I thought were my idols. And I was like, do I really want to be like that? You know, is that really the heart of Christ for people? And I really started questioning things. And it was I started deconstructing really then, before I even knew I was doing it. And it eventually led me to ask questions and get punished for asking those questions, and supporting different things. And then a tragedy happened in my life where I lost a longtime friend to suicide. And at the time, we were already talking about closing down Exodus, and I was already researching and doing a report for the board on whether we should stay open or not. And that happened at the same time. And really that ripped my blinders off, and right. my deconstruction went into hyperdrive at that point, because I could no longer deny how dangerous and deadly and destructive that reparative therapy, conversion therapy, ex-gay ministry, whatever you want to call it, it's toxic religion, was doing to myself and my friends.
Man. So you said a lot there. First thing that threw me off is you came out in the 80s. How old are you?
I'm 52.
Oh, wow.
You look really good for 52, man. You're not
like
52.
I would not have guessed that at
all.
Well,
thank you. You're my favorite host so far.
Yes. Suck it, Zach.
He did just ask you your age, like openly.
It's true.
I mean.
But okay. I did it in such a way. I mean, I was shocked. I'm 40, and I thought that I looked good for my age. And I mean, I would have thought you were like around my age or
yeah,
something.
Well, I appreciate
possibly
that.
Like younger,
thank
so.
You.
Yeah. No way. So in 1980, that's an interesting time to come out, especially I know a little bit of your story, but where were you living at that time? Were you in the South?
I was in Nashville, Tennessee. And
wow, so that's an interesting place to come out as well.
That's a very dangerous place to come yeah. out. And I wasn't out on my own volition. My mother found a Valentine's Day party invitation in my pants. I was 19. Aww. And it was definitely a gay invitation addressed to my boyfriend and I. There was no question with the artwork that was on the invitation that it was a gay party. And when she found out that I was gay, she threw me out of the house. And so I was living out of my car for 3 weeks and didn't really have a lot of options, but a drag queen named Carmela Marcella Garcia girl took me in at the time and showed me a different Jesus than what my mother had shown me when she kicked me out.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry you went through that. That's really rough, man. And so, but it sounds like your mother was pretty religious and was your father around as well?
Yeah, the weird thing is she wasn't. We weren't a religious, we were nominal Christians at best because Granny was a Christian. But I always say that the toxic cultural stigma started in our pulpits. She didn't learn that there was a special place in hell for gay people from, you know, the news anchor at Channel 4. She learned it from her parents, who did go to church right. regularly. Right. And so that toxic theology and stigmatizing view of gay people, I mean, it was the most detailed theological lesson she had ever given me as she was throwing me out of house, you know?
Yeah,
so
we're telling you where you're going to burn.
Right.
Well, that was the 80s. That, I mean, if you guys don't know, that was like just... You say toxic. I mean, I remember growing up playing Smear the Queer football, you know, sort of a thing. And then now it's just like, oh my God.
The AIDS epidemic, you know, was also in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there,
yeah, the height of the AIDS epidemic. And people were, you know, there was even at first people who were gay thought it was gay cancer.
Right.
What stigma came along with that, you know?
Yeah.
I also, and maybe this, so I want to ask a question here. So, like, for me, I was very, very close with my mother, like overshared everything. And so you just mentioned
still
that
does.
Is due.
Present tense. Yeah, where's the past tense there?
You just mentioned that you were 19, right? And you received a Valentine from another man who you are identifying as your boyfriend. So your mom didn't know.
Well, if she did, she didn't let on. We didn't actually have a close relationship.
Really?
We have a better relationship today than we have ever had before. So I'm very happy.
That's great to hear.
I'm very glad to see that. And that really didn't happen until I came out the second time until in 2015. But back then, we weren't very close. And I think she was genuinely shocked. I mean, I'm so butch.
All right.
it's the facial hair.
You have siblings then?
I'm sorry, babe. You go ahead. Go first, babe.
Do you think that would be partly the societal, because gay wasn't talked about in the 80s in like a it could be me kind of thing? Like I don't know, like I'm maybe I'm just young enough that we get to question that, right? Like I'm 37 and we get to question that. But is that do you think that had something to do with it, her attitude towards you?
Well, I, you know, it's really weird because there is like a whole confluence going on in the 80s. You know, you had Boy George, right. You had George Michael. And if it weren't for Prince and Lisa Lisa and the Cult Jam, I would not have survived high school. But I was, Prince ran around in lace. And that was amazing. Right. I was a very much a Prince fan. But I was such a shut down kid because of the abuse going on in my home and at school. I never talked. And I literally never talked. So I don't think she ever had a chance to figure out that I was actually gay. Now, I knew that I was gay early on. At 10 years old, I thought that I might be gay. And then when the Dukes of Hazzard came along and I fell in love with both Bo and Luke Duke, I really wanted to marry both of them. I was like, yeah, you're kind of gay. It took me two seasons. It took me two seasons to figure out that Daisy was their cousin, you know, and they were, you know, so I kind of came to a place of accepting that I was gay early on. And I think it, you know, visibility matters. I think it was people like Boy George. And I was like, okay, you know, they can do it, but I know that nobody else around here is going to get it. So I kept it quiet, tried not to let on. But of course, I got bullied at school because, you know, while the other kids were smearing the queer, as you said, I was over there arranging the fall leaves by color. Because I thought that was fun. Of course, I got picked on all the time. But I just wasn't a very talkative kid, which is weird now because you can't shut me up.
You're making up for it. Yes, you're making up definitely. For it now. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry to hear you mentioned something, and let's go ahead and go there if you don't mind, about, you know, a little bit of your childhood, and mentioned that, you know, there was an abusive situation going on. And you mentioned your relationship with your mother and how she's the one who ended up kicking you out of the house. I'm going to do it like a two-part question. So first, about your mom, do you think that she was genuinely concerned about your afterlife when she was yelling at you and upset, or was she more concerned about the image that she was going to have of having a gay son in the 80s? And then where was your dad in this? What was your family situation like, siblings and all that different stuff?
Well, my mother, I think she was genuinely afraid of me getting AIDS. That was the main thing that she was screaming at me. She thought, I think in her toxic religious way, she was having an existential crisis for me. She thought I was involved in deadly behavior. And her only context was in, of course, this horrible religious context. She didn't know how to react. And because she was so afraid that I was going to die, I think that's why she acted the way she did. I mean, it took me three therapists, real therapy, not conversion therapy, but real therapy, to figure out that in her way, she was literally afraid of me dying. And a mother would react. She used the wrong context and didn't make it better, but she was a mother reacting for fear that I was going to die. Because we weren't really social people. We weren't religious people. I really think it was just pure existential threat or fear. So that led me to an understanding of her that I was able to forgive her even before we were able to get to where we are today. And my bio dad, he's not in the picture. I tried to find him a couple of times, but he just doesn't have any interest. So he's my bio dad. I try not to disrespect him, but we don't have a relationship. I don't have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah.
And no siblings?
No, I have a younger brother. He lives in San Diego with my three nieces. And so, yeah. And he's always been accepting of me.
Awesome. That's and awesome. I got one more question about your family, then you guys can take it from there, whichever direction you want to go. But are you, and as far as coming out in your family, are you the only person, or is there more that you're aware of? You have your younger brother or cousins or anything like that that have come out before or since you have?
Well, I come from a long line of Tennessee hillbillies, and as far as I know, there's not a single LGBTQ plus person in the entire lineage, and I'm very happy about that, because it was like the universe was like, hey, there you go. And I'm very glad to disrupt that. Now,
what takes a special person, and like you said, you're finding your allies from, like, you know, your heroes in pop culture. And wow, I was just wondering if you had anybody, you know, in your immediate family that you could look to as well, but it didn't sound like it. So that's, I mean, it takes a special person to be able to, like, be born into a family like that and, you know, live to tell about it.
Right. Well, my cousins, they're conservative in a lot of ways, but they're all accepting of me as a gay man today. But the older generations knew. Yeah. I mean, my mom's coming That's along kind of. Like, she asks about my fiance and how the 13-year-old is doing and those types of things, which she would never have asked of before. But, you know, anyway. Right.
Small steps.
Yeah. Right. I want to get into the whole Exodus story. Take us back to, because you said your family was nominally Christian, okay? Nominally Christian. I don't understand how a gay man in the 80s goes from being nominally Christian to the VP of Exodus. So you had some sort of a conversion, you know, an actual conversion experience where you, you know, probably gave your life to Christ or whatever, had some sort of a born again experience. Tell us about that.
Well, I came out in the 80s, but just because you come out of the closet doesn't mean you're happy. It doesn't mean you're a healthy person. And I was not. I had just come out of a very abusive household. I was diagnosed in 2005 with PTSD because of what I went through in the household and at my school. So when I was forced out of the closet and lived in my car for 3 weeks, I was not a healthy person. And I found a very dark party scene. And I watched so many people die from the AIDS crisis and got involved in my own, you know, doing abusing substances, all kinds of terrible things. You know, just to numb the pain. I was not a happy person at all. And so I ended up on a Greyhound bus going to Dallas, Texas, that my Christian aunt had bought me one way to, you know, change the scenery kind of situation. And I was involved in the 12-step program for a while. I'm not currently today, but I do think that that 12-step program gave me the space to finally get my bearings. But unfortunately, like, Jesus started picking off all of my small group at this 12-step program. Wow. It was very irritating to me because I didn't like Christians at the time, with a lot of good reasons, which will be in the book, I'm sure. but I didn't really care for that. But eventually, it started making sense to me. And I do believe... And I still believe that I'm a Christian, although most Christians don't think I am one. But I did become a Christian in 1992. And I got involved in this one church. You know, they were like, you need to go to this groovy church, because my friends at this 12-step program, they knew me. They knew me before I became the raging evangelical that I eventually became. And they were like, well, go visit this church. And it was a very charismatic, non-denominational, you know, and I went expecting, you know, blue hair, Bible thumping, pew jumping, all kinds of people. But I went in there and they were artists. They're musicians. They didn't have a choir. They had a band and they actually harmonized. And they invited me to their potlucks and whatever, and would drink wine. And I was just like, these people are kind of cool, you know? And when I would tell them my shocking stories, cause I wanted to test them, they would be like, and, you know, and I'm like, how love these people. They weren't what I was expecting, which was very disarming. And I was like, you know, all right, fine. I used to sleep with dudes. What do you think about that? And they're like, we love gay people. We've got a special group on Thursdays for gay people. And I was like, you know, and, right. And they were like, and I had never heard of Exodus, but I had heard of ex-gay, whatever, and I thought that was ridiculous. But I went and visited this group, and, you know, I lived in Arlington, Texas at the time, which I wish that I had just run down the street to Dallas and gone to the largest gay church in the world, but I didn't. And I visited this group, and again, I was expecting them to threaten me and manipulate me with hell and all this other stuff, and they didn't. And I was asking all these, you know, pretty straightforward, kind of rude questions, and they were like, Randy, if you don't want to come to our group, you don't have to be here. And I'm like, wait, you're supposed to threaten me with hell and stuff and tell me I have to play football and whatever. And it was it was very disarming. It wasn't what I was expecting.
Well, don't you know that God has a big house with a great big yard where we can play football? big.
That's a song, isn't it?
So yeah, something like that. Close to a song.
Right. One of those silly Christian songs.
Yeah, but one of the, and I'll wrap this up, but one of the first night that I went, they didn't even talk about homosexuality. They talked about emotional and codependency, which is something, which was my default relational style. But they blamed that on being gay. It's not that it could be a human issue that that different people deal with. It was because I was gay that I was codependent and emotionally dependent. But because it met...
That's that, kind of fucked up.
Yeah, well, it's one of the hooks. It's one of the things that I know now as a hook. It hooked me because it was a legitimate issue in my life, but they blamed it on being gay. And so I was like, oh my God, I've never heard this before. That is so me. I'm so effed up. I'm here, you know? And I learned how to
So it's got you codependent on something else. That they didn't actually change, like, work on that part of you. They just basically are like, oh, we can manipulate you and get you to basically.
Right. Well, I call it like a poison pill. Like, it did help me with understanding emotional dependency, but it didn't help because it blamed being gay for being emotionally dependent. It didn't treat it as the one issue alone. Everything stemmed from the sin of homosexuality. So all these legitimate issues were used as hooks to keep pulling you in. And as long as you're working on this legitimate issue, it will help you overcome homosexuality, which is a total lie. You know, every human being has the propensity for dysfunction. They didn't treat it like that. They treated it like it was a result from being gay. And because I had such a dark experience in the gay community in the 80s, it was easy for me to scapegoat being gay. It was easy for me to think, yeah, that's such a depraved thing because I saw a lot of crazy stuff. But the truth is that there's a book called The Velvet Rage by a psychologist, Alan Downs, and it talks about how gay people are blamed for their dysfunctions when they shouldn't be. That it's not a problem for being gay that you have. It's not because you're gay that you have all these problems. You have all these problems because you have all these problems. You're just a gay person who's experiencing those. Whereas the ex-gay conversion therapy world wants to blame everything on being gay. Scapegoats being gay because of toxic theology and cultural stigma. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does.
I mean, it makes sense, but it seems like the exact definition of like homophobia.
Exactly. You
know, I mean, it's called everything is on like this main fear being gay. And it's like, seems so ridiculous. Like, I get it, especially that time and how where we all grew up. But I mean, how can your mental, like, because we all have a dependency or capacity for codependency and different stuff like that. So is that just like we all have a little bit of gay in us? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. And you're right. It is the textbook definition of bigotry. You run everything through that filter of hatred.
It's internalized homophobia is what it is. And it's taught interesting.
Internal homophobia. Because that's not something you were told that. It's not something you just lived knowing.
Yeah, but it's so
brainwashing.
It's like shame and guilt over and over again. But I've always found that I chose when I went through my experience, I chose to go, right? Like it was my personal decision. And I want so much to be able to say, no, I was forced there. Because then it would like justify like all of the crap that happened. But it sounds like you chose to go there as well. I mean, that this was something that they kind of bought that, they sold that pitch, right? That there's something wrong with you and you need help and we have the answer. And then it made it so it's not just the gay thing, it's everything and it'll fix my life. And you kind of bought the ticket.
I did. And, you know, there's two different docu-series. One is the Scientology series by Leah Remini. And another one is the new Nexium series that's on HBO, the secular sex cult up in New York. Guy just crazy. Got like 100 and something years of federal prison time. But one of the guys in the Nexium docuseries says no one joins a cult. No one, right. They always join a good thing, something that's presented as a good thing. And yes, you're right. I chose to go that Thursday night, but there's those hooks that keep you coming back. You know, it's to the point where you really don't, because I thought for the longest time, for 20 something years, I was called celibacy because that was my only option. And when that's your
only... You and Paul, right? You and Paul the Apostle.
Right. I thought I was something special. And it's like, no, you're just in a cult. And it hurt to realize that. But there is a point where it doesn't become a choice, where the consequences are so high to leave that it's just not an option anymore. And you learned helplessness. You learn to live in the pain because you feel like that's your only option.
Yeah.
So how long does the program initially last? Like if somebody were to, at that point, have joined Exorcist, is it like a year long, like do they call it discipleship program? What do they call it? Like rehab? How do they approach, you know, the reparative therapy?
And did you have to pay for it?
Right. Well, the thing about, I don't think, one of the things that I think is misunderstood about Exodus is that it wasn't the Starbucks of religious stigma. It didn't have a particular program or a particular price. There was all kinds of different curriculum and different ways of doing things. Like Exodus at its height had 251 member agencies in three different networks. There was the church network, which may or may not have had a group, but they just supported they agreed with the theology of Exodus. There was the professional counselor network, which you would more associate with the conversion therapy of today. And there was also the peer-based member ministry network, which could be anything from an organized nonprofit to just a group that met in a church like the one I did, the one that I was in before I moved, became a part of Exodus. So there was all kinds of different programs, and some of them would charge. Like there's one, I was a Living Waters coordinator. We had that curriculum at the ministry or the organization that I ran in Texas before I joined Exodus, and that was a 30-week program that cost like $800, whereas our regular support groups where you can donate if you want to, you don't have to, kind of thing. But those conversion therapy therapist folks, they really like to charge by the hour.
And so you were just going to a support group then at first, right?
At first, yeah. Before I went into leadership, and in leadership, I helped bring in the paid curriculums.
So how did you get into actually being a paid member of Exodus? So you went through your
president.
Reparative therapy. Okay. You went through the reparative therapy. Did you feel any less gay And then how did you become the vice president? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting because I never knew who I was. And so the crafting of who Randy became was really, you know, and I can say this now because I don't have any shame, but I was a narcissist. I had completely built my own persona. I thought I was this, you know, call to celibacy, you know, advocate, ex-gay advocate, all this other stuff. And so, you know, the struggles were always blamed on temptation. Oh, that's Satan. He's so crafty. And it's you could hyper-spiritualize things. You just built this whole world around what you're supposed to be instead of who you really are. And that's not going to last. And it didn't. And so I, you know, when I went to that group, about a year after that, the leader of the group asked me to start answering letters that the ministry would get. That's back when we used to write with pencils on paper. and I would respond to that. And then I became a small group leader. And I had never really had the space to kind of exercise my own gifts. And even though it was my superpowers were being used for evil, I didn't know it at the time. And so I was really good at leading small groups, and I was really good at speaking and teaching. And I started getting invited to different conferences and speaking around the country. And then that caught the eye of the person who would eventually become the president of Exodus. So when he took over Exodus in 2002, he asked me to be on staff with him. I came on as the membership director, went into the press person position, and eventually up to the vice president position.
Did you have any formal schooling for any of that, or did they send you to any training, or was it all just going through some of their own classes and teaching it yourself? Did you have any schooling for the reparative therapy stuff, or religiously were you schooled?
That? Right. Well, can I cuss?
Fuck yeah.
Yes.
It was, I'm a good bullshitter. I know how to tell a story. And that's pretty much the whole ex-gay conversion.
You said you were going to cuss. I missed it.
The whole, well, I thought shit was a word. yes, it's bullshit.
I think that's PG-13. That doesn't count.
Okay. Well, fuck. I'll have to think of something else.
There you go. Okay. Step your game up.
Well, okay, I know. You pretty much were guaranteed success if you knew how to tell your story. And even though I really believed it, I knew how to tell a story. And that's one of the things that if you ever get in a conversation with an ex-gay ministry leader, is ask them what their credentials are. They don't have any.
Right.
And with conversion therapy, you do have psychologists who are involved. So that is some credentials. But that was like 30 out of the 251 member agencies.
Right.
People in the churches and all this other stuff, they have no business presenting themselves as counselors.
But as long as you love the Lord, then that's all that matters. Just point people to Jesus and he'll just work out all your problems.
Yeah. Well, Omar and I worked for a discipleship training school and Assemblies of God and a drug rehabilitation center. So we were technically counselors or staff. Right. So I totally get the, I am not qualified for this shit thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That was not us. I mean, we were not qualified, but we did it.
No, right. we were doing our very best. And then in the, our spare time, I was smoking weed in the bathroom of the parsonage. But I wanted to ask you about that and being a bullshitter and unqualified and being quote unquote celibate for the time that you're working with.
Well, he said it didn't last.
That's what I heard that. You see, you heard the same thing I did too. So that's what I want to know is as the VP of Exodus, how much tell are you? How much tell are you actually getting?
Omar,
he asked it on live Facebook Live. My husband, ladies and gentlemen,
that is fine. I, you know, I...
Were you getting any?
I was not, actually.
I was a true believer.
I was a true believer.
And the narcissist and you wouldn't let you do it, huh?
No, would not. And that was basically it, because that false self-image of self-righteousness and all this other stuff, I wanted to be the guy that said, no, I didn't. And
yeah.
And I didn't. Now I wish I had, because once I allowed myself that freedom, life changing in a good way. But anyway, but no, at the time I didn't.
No, it just reminded me of that time I went to a charismatic church and they had a Wednesday night service with a prayer. And asking to vote no on this thing for that was going to be in promotion of LGBT freedoms and rights and certain legislation and housing stuff. And so I went up to them and I said, I'm gay and I don't want to be. What can you do for me? And they said, well, do you want to lead our ex-gay ministry?
Really?
I kid you not, Randy. And this is just a short story because it's funny, because I literally then went to some of their meetings and they wanted to make me one of the counselors.
I was like, all right.
Well, none of these men are attractive, so it didn't last very long. But that was kind of funny. Yeah. Related.
Well, it's interesting just talking about the church as far as how they always put people who are unqualified in charge of people's souls, which is if you're the church, that's the most important commodity that you have.
Right. Yes. So
you'd think that they would actually care about the people that they're putting in these things, but the thing, it always, at least in the denomination I was in, they would tell you, well, that's the best way to conquer your sin is to bring it out into the light and to talk about it, and as long as you're teaching these ministries, then your own guilt or whatever it is going to keep you from sinning. All it's going to do is keep you from being able to talk about it if you are struggling. It doesn't really keep you from doing anything.
Right.
Well, unless you, I don't know, apparently you manage, so congratulations.
I can tell you right now that Seth did not manage.
Well, there also wasn't Grindr back then either, so that probably would have made things a little harder for you. Technology wasn't against you at that point.
What was that slam?
Speaking of Grindr,
Seth, get off Grindr.
Yeah.
I'm not on Grindr right at the moment.
You have to turn your phone on. Then the Grindr app will work.
Right. So, all right. So you've been the VP of Exodus International. You've done, some work that you're probably not proud of, right? Okay. How in the hell did you get out of all that?
Well, it's kind of slow, but it kind of wasn't. We were involved with the Arlington Group and the DC Group, and those were two very high profile, but supposed to be secret groups of people like Dr. Dobson and Tony Perkins. And I met Kellyanne Conway there. I met Mike Pence and his staff at those meetings. And
okay, Randy, yeah. You saw Mike Pence in person?
Yeah.
Okay. Gaydar.
Totally.
I
might have been tempted.
Really?
The evil one may have tempted me.
I mean, I have Gaydar from just TV, but I'm I want it confirmed if you've seen him in person.
No, I don't know for a fact that he struggles, but it would not surprise me at all.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I was a part of those groups and, back when Romney and McCain and Obama were going at it for 2008, I sat in the peanut gallery. My boss was one of the principals. And, I just said one meeting, and I'm not making this up. If they didn't hate me so much, they could back me up. But I said, I think we really need to be watching Obama because he's the only one the country is listening to right now. And I was laughed at. When Romney was running, they said they couldn't vote for a Mormon. And I was like, he's the only one who can do math. And they, and so I was like, these folks aren't, they are what I always thought they were before. And that they were self-defeating. And so politically, I was starting to lose my faith in our faith leaders. And then I just started, you know, we really started questioning. There was a lot of young people. We had a lot of interns in the office, and they were like, do we really change? You know how young people can be so annoying that way. And they're like, do we really change? Is Exodus fulfilling its mission and all this other stuff? And we're like, okay, let's have that honest discussion.
Yeah, asking good questions.
Yeah. And yeah. So we started asking those questions among our leadership. And these people that I had lionized, that I had put on a pedestal, that I had protected, that I had promoted, they turned on a dime just for us asking the questions. And we were still hardcore, you know, meeting Newt Gingrich, Karl Rove at these meet and greets and all this other stuff. We were hardcore religious right. But just because we were asking those questions, you know, we were being used of the devil and those types of things.
Making people uncomfortable.
Yeah. And so that really kind of opened my eyes. As I mentioned, Brandon mentioned in his interview, it's like, is that the person that I want to be in 10 years?
Right.
That's not the fruit of the spirit.
And that's also a clear sign of a cult, right? Whenever you're not allowed to question right. things, especially whenever it comes to the cult of Christianity, whenever you're not allowed to question. I mean, even the Bible talks about certain people wrestling with God, mm-hmm. you know, certainly figuratively.
That's what the Jewish faith is all about.
Right.
Right. You know, it's interesting to see the difference there. Right. You know, it's not real Christianity. It's toxic religion. Right.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I started seeing, you know, I love the teachings of Jesus. I'm still consider myself a Christian, a universalist Christian, if that means anything. But I love his teachings and the fruit of the Spirit. I got focused on where's the fruit of the Spirit. And I was not seeing it in my peers anymore. I was not seeing it in the people that I was supposed to be leading and protecting and promoting and all this other stuff. I was seeing the opposite. Instead of kindness, I was seeing malice. Instead of generosity, I was seeing negative assumptions, you know, and it was just like, it was so eye-opening. But even then, it took the death of my friend that I mentioned earlier to just rip the blinders off. And after that happened, and I was writing a report in the midst of that, even before that, for the board on whether we should shut down Exodus or not, because it had gotten so bad. It was like the nonprofit version of a huge denominational split. They were so mad at us for asking questions, thinking about redoing our mission statement, that they were splitting. They were creating their own network that took the very worst parts of Exodus and amplified them exponentially. And it was getting so bad that we weren't only questioning whether Exodus had fulfilled its mission. Functionally, it was falling apart because they were taking donors, they were taking member agencies out. And then when Michael passed away, I told my boss that I was going to leave whether the board voted to close Exodus or not. But I would stay until we made that presentation, but I was going to recommend that they close Exodus. And he fully agreed. He was already there. I didn't know it, but when we had that discussion, we were like, yeah, Exodus needs to close. It's not only not fulfilled its mission, it's become deadly.
Yeah, was Michael then involved with Exodus at the time as well? Is that kind of like what was more even insult to injury?
Yeah. Michael, he was actually a part of the 12-step program I was a part of. And he went back into the church closet before I did. And then I went into the church closet, and then I became a leader at that local group. And he went to the group that I led for 2 years, which is something I'll always regret. Yeah. But he went back to being gay. He actually embraced who he truly was. And he got involved in a relationship that was very unhealthy. And a lot of very terrible things happened. And because of that, and because of the toxic things that we had believed in, he thought God was punishing him. Mm. And so he took his life.
Mm. I'm sorry for your loss.
It never gets easier to share that, but he,
yeah.
And this Michael was beautiful. He was a beautiful man. He was so smart. He was like IQ in the 150s. He knew his stuff backwards and forwards. He was the guy that you always got to have those fun arguments with about any kind of topic. And he was just a beautiful person. And when he took his life because he thought God might be punishing him, I could no longer hyper-spiritualize this away. I couldn't blame Satan because Michael knew his stuff. He was not given to just whims. And for the power of those beliefs to lead a strong man like that, I knew that there was something incredibly wrong with where we were now. I'd been told those things, but until I knew a person directly that I could not excuse away, it didn't rip my blinders off until Michael passed away. And so at that moment, I knew I didn't really know all the stuff that I would deconstruct and know today, but I knew that I had to get out of there, that I would not support the board hiring a new executive director, that we had to shut it down. And I would say, helping to shut down Exodus, it wasn't me. I didn't get to make the decision, but helping to shut it down was one of the best things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
It definitely sounds like it.
That's powerful, man. That's really powerful. I have a question.
I think we all have so many questions.
Go ahead,
Elizabeth. Connection issues. I am having connection issues, so I'm not going to turn my video on just in case I have the call drops again. But what year would that have been that Exodus ended, and where did you go from there? Like, I have more questions than that, but let's start there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we announced the closing of Exodus on June 19th of 2013. At the conference that we were, yearly conference, I hit the enter on the press release when he made the announcement. And, and after that, I laid myself off from a job that paid pretty well, and I had no clue what was going to happen next. And it was incredibly difficult, for me personally. I thought that I was going to be at that job for the rest of my life, and now I'm like, what now? I didn't know who I was, and I think through my own counseling, real counseling and spiritual journey, I was able to pull out the real me from what had been used for negative, for bad. But I also was able to reach out to some LGBTQ+ people that I had met over the years. We had been kind of frenemies before. They would tell me the truth. They're like, we don't like what you're doing at Exodus. Exodus is responsible for so much horribleness in this world, but our door is open to you kind of people. Mm. And after we closed down Exodus, I just reached out to them. And one particular man named Ben, he's a voiceover artist in Palm Springs now. I asked him some really pointed and rude questions. I've apologized to him because I had no business asking someone the kind of questions that I did. But he was very transparent about at the time he was engaged. And I was like, man, he's got more of the fruit of the Spirit than most people I've ever met. And I never saw it before. And that was kind of what I was looking for at the time. It was my only anchor is like, where is the fruit of the Spirit? Where is love, kindness, graciousness, steadfastness? Where is it?
Or when you're teaching people to suppress themselves, like how are they supposed to ever express any of those actual emotions? Because spending all day long learning to hate themselves. So how do you do that?
Right. Yeah. Well,
so
I'm sorry.
2013 was the same year everything got shut down for us too. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Just a month before you.
Oh, cool. Well, it was
we were going through year. 2013 sucked. Let's just put it
that way. Well, I used to say 2013 was the worst year ever, but I think this one's giving it a run for its money. It,
you know, I agree with that. Yeah.
Until the last election, I should say, but that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, it looked like it was going to get better, and then everything started shutting down. But go ahead, Seth, with your question.
Yeah, I'm curious because you mentioned that, because my question in hearing that story was, what was the reception from the gay community afterwards? You know, because I was imagining that probably didn't go very well, and that there'd been a lot of hate and a lot of blame and a lot of...
It's kind of like when a cop gets arrested and he's, you know, like locked in the prison cell and they're like, oh, you know, I'm going to fuck this dude up.
Well, but you're explaining that you reached out to some people that you felt were supportive and were able to form some meaningful bonds there.
Sounds like they gave you some grace.
They did.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I'm gay. So, I mean, I'm just saying, I'm just curious. So was it primarily positive?
Well, it's interesting. The process of me coming to the place of coming out again, which I did on January 12th of 2015, those kind people, I reached out to people I knew would not, you know, eviscerate me. And they didn't, you know, it's interesting when I share my story. I call it a tale of two closets. I go from one toxic religious view to Carmela Marcela Garcia, who welcomes me into her home after 3 weeks of living in my car in Jesus' name. This is a drag queen inviting me into her home in Jesus' name, you know. And then all these years later, I go from a toxic religious environment, and now I'm turning to a gay voiceover artist. I'm turning to a lesbian author that I had met over the years. I'm asking them very pointed questions, and that's exactly what it was. It was pure grace. And it was a grace that I had never had come close a couple of times in the church, but had never experienced. These people had every reason to say, you know what, F you. Get the fuck out of my face. You did all these horrible things, said all these horrible things, and you can Google and find these horrible things that I did. They could have said that, but they didn't. They knew that I was in pain, hurting, and involved in a cult, and they gave me living water. They gave me refreshment. They gave me a safe place to ask these questions. Now, when I came out, and even when we closed Exodus, there was all kinds of gay people, and there's still gay people today that hate my guts. They don't want to hear me doing anything. They tell me that I need to go crawl under the rock that I came out from under, that I have no business doing interviews or the advocacy work that I do with Thrive. And I get it. I don't blame them at all. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think it's okay at all. I think it's horrible that that's happening.
Well, you know, I kind of understand where they're coming from because I represent a lot of pain and I represent a lot of hurt that a lot of them went through. And so I give everyone the space they need. If they have a lot of negative things to say, you know, like one man said, "Don't you see the blood on your hands?" And I said, I'm afraid to look at my hands. I was always a true believer. I never thought that what I was doing was hurtful, but I do understand now that it was, and that there's a lot of very negative consequences that people have dealt with that I'm associated with. And so if they need the space to be angry and mad, okay, I get it. They want to be unforgiving. I'm unforgiving of myself in some things. I'm about to marry a dude next year, and I lobbied against it. I lobbied against it for so many years. You know, so I get what being angry at me is like. And so I appreciate you saying that, but I don't blame them at all.
I think it's extremely important for people to hear this story because, you know, the culture right now is if there's someone that's doing this kind of work that's against, you know, LGBTQ rights, it's cancel them and cancel them now. And it's like, no, if you are like, forgive me if I get it wrong, Carmela Marcela Garcia, mm-hmm. if you're like that person and you're showing grace, mm-hmm. you're going to change someone's life mm-hmm. and you're going to change it for the better, right? So this whole idea of cancel culture is the absolute worst thing you can do. It's going to drive more people in the direction of Exodus International, I think. And so I'm so happy that you've, you know, found grace from a community, you know, that at one point, you know, maybe you weren't so kind to.
Right.
And now you get an opportunity with Thrive. Mm-hmm. And of course, we want to talk about that as well. You get an opportunity with Thrive to hopefully find redemption there. And so what exactly do you do at Thrive? And what is it?
Yeah, what is Thrive? I'm curious of that as well. And I really appreciate, before we go any further, Randy, just your vulnerability and telling some of these stories, you know, and as we were talking about Michael and stuff, I really appreciate you, man. And even your, with this last response you had to Seth's question or you know, just the honesty of, you know, I think we all can relate to knowing what it's like to have a hard time forgiving ourselves for things that we've done in our past. And it sounds like Thrive, that we're getting ready to hear more about, is maybe some way of finding redemption for some of the things you did while you were at Exodus. But I'm also curious, because you said Exodus shut down in 2013. And then 2 years later is when you actually came out again of the closet. Mm-hmm. The 2 years in between there is probably a whole nother podcast of just like what it was like, where you're at, you know, to where you've, you know, you gave us this little snapshot with Carmela and the different, the LGBT community that you found. So anyway, let's hear about Thrive. I appreciate you, man. That's all I really wanted to say. There's no question there, I don't think.
No, that's
cool. And before he jumps in on this, one thing I just want to point out the irony of, okay, truly, is that the ministry, like reparative therapy, conversion therapy, all of these things, they started to look very unlike Christ, but it's what the church was trying to do to be biblical. And if you follow the actual biblical Jesus, it's accepting yourself. Is his message not come as you are? It's just so ironic. Omar? The irony of that, though, that literally stepping away from something that's ordained by the church is actually bringing you closer to the God that the church is supposed to represent. It's just, you know, irony. But continue on.
Well, and that's an irony that's been happening for thousands of years. Jesus was definitely stepping away from the church at the time and preaching a whole new gospel. Then
whole new world.
And, you know, then religion took over, Christianity hijacked it. And it's just been this whole thing. You know, and it's the problem with organized religion is that humans put themselves at the top of the chain instead of actually, you know, looking for the spiritual elements. And for those who, you know, aren't of faith, there is something transcendent in just finding our connectedness to one another. You know, there's something about being human that is transcendent to the rest of nature. And so there's so much beauty there that we get so lost in when we come up with all these rules and hierarchies and tiers and all this other stuff. You know, this is the biblical answer is probably the first red flag. If you hear someone say this is the biblical answer, just run, you know, because
I would 100% agree with that statement. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I'm a universalist Christian. You know, I love my faith now. I feel like I'm closer to God than I've ever been in my life because I find that the divine is in all of us, you know. And anyway, so
to talk about irony, isn't that ironic? It's the thing that I was most afraid of becoming when I was a evangelical Pentecostal Christian. As I've become that, it just seems like the most correct way to be than I've ever been in my entire life. You know, that.
What is it? You always say, Omar, you become your fears.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah, I know. And it's very interesting to me because I, in my path, I did have these spiritual experiences throughout growing up that continued through my closet years in the church closet, and continued to this day, you know. And I've found that when I was involved in that cult, I was, that those were true blinders. They don't want you to be free. They don't want you to experience that transcendent nature within yourself in any particular way, except in ways that they can define and control. And, you know, that's an argument that's been had for generations, but I found the same thing, Omar. It's once I got the blinders off, I finally got to experience reality and less, and it's so much less stressful, so much more free.
Yeah, it's funny too that they called it Exodus. It's almost prophetic in that way, because didn't they only just wander in the desert for 40 years and never actually go anywhere?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And all of them dropped dead. Yeah, you know, as far as...
Never got to see their, you know, promised land.
Yeah. They wandered around, they made excuses, they hurt people, people died. And the very people that are supposed to be leading them, I think Joshua was the one who led them in there, but Moses never saw the promised land. All of that generation never got to see anything. And as much as I don't like the rest of the story, the younger generation is not buying into it. And they're not going to put up with wandering around in the desert like that. And I think for me, I mean, it's always going to take on a new form, but the ex-gay world that I was a part of, it's on its last gasps. That doesn't mean
God.
That doesn't mean that it's going to not be there in some form or fashion. It will be, but as far as those ex-gay support groups, they're not thriving at all, and that makes me very happy.
It's so sad that the reality is, though, it takes that generation dying off for it to actually. For any real change to happen. But this generation coming up, and we have kids and stuff too, I'm just so excited for the future that they might have with, you know, the different rallies and protests and voices that are being spoken now. And let's hear about Thrive.
Okay, great. Well, Thrive,
you like that transition? Not really? Well, just stick it right in there, right?
Chris just asked the question like 20 minutes ago, and we're finally getting to it. Right. So anyway, that's all you.
We all had a piece to say.
Right. Well, Thrive pretty much exists to educate against sexual orientation change efforts. We're pretty much educational outreach. We do advocacy work when we get a chance. Just recently, for example, the 11th Circuit Appeals Court struck down all of the Florida conversion therapy bans. And so I'll be on a national town hall Monday night to talk about that. And
so that means they can reopen camps and stuff there in Florida? I didn't realize that was stuff that's going on. That's crazy, man.
Well, the 2-1 court... two appointed by Trump to one, struck down all the conversion therapy bans in Florida. Okay. And so they can fire those things back up. They did it in the name of religious freedom and freedom of speech. And so
you're making Seth sound right now.
Yeah,
I know. And this is what I've been speaking to, but again, sorry, Randy, there's a big joke right now. And among our team that I made a big deal about voting for Joe Biden because of, I felt like another 4 years, the way things were going, they were going to kick gay marriage back to the States.
Right.
He was telling me that I hate gay people because I voted for Joe Jorgensen.
And so. I live in Missouri, and I have people that say they love me and yet are voting for a candidate that is doesn't have a chance. And
but she loved gay people too. I don't understand.
I don't. Well, come on. She wasn't going to win. Yeah. I don't.
The
think,
outcome is what I
don't think that even if it were kicked back to the states that they would allow that to happen. I think so, it's done. So, it's a done deal.
Sorry about that.
It's well, anyway. Sorry, Randy. So it sounds like on. That
there's
moving on. Moving
it
on.
Sounds like there's stuff still happening though in this regard, and you're now going to be on a town hall about it. So yeah.
Yeah, and I'm kind of with you. The damage that the current administration has done to our community won't be felt for another couple, three years, but it's there. Court was two of the three were appointed by him, and I'm sure it was because Pence and the Bishop Harry Jackson, who recently passed away, I'm sure that they advised him to do that. They are looking forward to the Supreme Court knocking down gay marriage. Where it ends up after that, I don't know. But we don't need to rest on our laurels, because one thing that I did learn about the religious right is they never play for the short term. They're always in it for the long term, as far as their strategy and goals and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, we need more people like you and Brandon to like that were involved, you know, maybe on the right at one point and have seen what the religious right's doing and pushing back and being a voice saying, hey, you can be on the left and still love Jesus and you can be as queer as you want to be and be accepted. And I think it's beautiful. And is there ways people can, if they want to know more about Thrive? And I see that hand, Chris. Am I moving too fast?
Yeah, I have something too. Thrive is mostly for the it mostly deals with government issues to help the LGBTQ community. Is that what I'm understanding?
No, we do we do educational as well. Like I get people who will contact me privately through messages or emails, and so I provide direct support as far as, you know, just being somebody there with a listening ear and experience that people can draw from. And I'm a part of two different documentaries. One is called Pray Away, and the other one is called For They Know Not What They Do. And both of them were premiered at Tribeca. And so there's a lot of personal education, you know, if you want to call it that, but cultural outreach, those types of things, cultural education, that's more of where my passion is at. Advocacy, of course, politically is very important. Don't want to minimize that at all, but my heart is to change hearts and minds and to convince people that whether we have a conversion therapy ban or not, it is deadly to young people and even old people like me to be a part of that world. And so we look for any opportunity to help change hearts and minds to be LGBTQ plus affirming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have really appreciated you being extremely vulnerable to come on here and tell this story. And I know it's not easy. It can't be easy. You've got balls, man. And I really appreciate you for, you know, telling this. And I would say, you know, there's probably going to be somebody, whether it's a person that went through Exodus or a family member of someone that went through Exodus, that's going to listen to this interview and you have their ear. If you could say anything to those people, what would you say to them?
I would say and I know that they're there. I know that people reach out to me all the time. First of all, if you want to talk, call, email, message, do whatever you do. I never break confidence. And I don't make judgments. I'm not going to tell you what to believe. I definitely have opinions. If you want my opinion, I'll give you my opinion. But overall, is I know the pressure of what it means to think that we have to do the right thing in order to love correctly. That we've been taught that the only way to love people who struggle with same-sex attractions is to steer them toward ex-gay type of ministries and conversion therapy. What I'm going to ask you to humbly ask you to consider is look for the fruit of the Spirit. the fruit of the Spirit. You will know a tree by its fruit. You know, we're talking to Christians here. So if I'm getting into Christianese for some people who may be watching, please forgive me for just this one moment. But to the Christian who's watching, look for the fruit of the Spirit. If you genuinely ask the Lord to show you where the fruit of the Spirit is, you will see that it's in affirming his LGBTQ plus children. That is where the fruit of the Spirit is. Everything else is legalism. Everything else is performance-based. Look for the fruit of the Spirit. And for if you're a parent, that LGBTQ plus child, your gay, lesbian, trans child, is beautiful. The way they are is how God created them to bring beauty into the world, relational beauty into the world. Let them be who he created them to be. And look for the fruit of the Spirit. And if you have questions, you want to yell at me and tell me how much I'm wrong, feel free to do that too. I've heard it before. I can take it. So my door's always open, and nothing but unconditional love and complete confidence. I won't break your confidence.
Awesome, man. I really appreciate it. And I hope that that door that's open is not the closet door. I hope that door slams shut. You won't go back there ever again.
The thing about the stained glass closet is that it broke pretty easily. I slammed that door and shattered all that stained glass.
Good. Appreciate you, man. Thanks for what you're doing now. Thanks for your vulnerability. And congratulations on your marriage. And it sounds like you said you have like a 13-year-old child as well that's coming with this relationship. Is that what I heard?
Yes. Well, Dan and I celebrated 4 years together. Yes, I started dating pretty quickly after I came back out.
Well, good. Okay. Yeah, I mean, you had a lot of time. Sure, you had a lot of time to make up for. I mean, yeah. 2 decades of celibacy. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, what was your Pornhub account like when you were working for Exorcist? I didn't ask that question. That should be a follow-up question right before.
You should not be watching.
What's a Pornhub? Listen, I don't know.
And let's be honest, if you're coming out of Exorcist, forget Pornhub and Hello Bathhouse. I mean, that is where... I mean, why are you spending all your time alone? Get out there and have some fun.
I did start dating pretty quickly. And actually, the first guy, okay, this is kind of, I didn't play around when I was at Exodus, but the first guy I dated outside of Exodus was a former Exodus leader.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, you had a connection there at least, you know, something that you were, you know, living out at least one of those fantasies, you know. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on 4 years, getting married next year. Tell us a little bit more about, yes. You said Dan.
His name is Dan. Dan Scobie. He doesn't mind me saying his name.
Okay, cool.
We've been together 4 years. We're getting married April 23rd of next year. He has we have a 13-year-old daughter now, and I'm her fairy godmother on good days and the bonus dad on other days. And so she's 13 now. Of course, I've known her since she was 9. So love her, love him, and I'm marrying a dude.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
That's great.
And thanks. Your mother, sounds like you have a good relationship with her, and so she's in support. How's Dan's family?
They're supportive. They're kind of on the same page. It's like we don't go into the nitty gritty of what it means to be gay with any of them, but they're all going to try to be.
They're not buying you guys sex toys or anything for your bachelor party or whatever.
Yeah, we don't talk about our favorite.
Seth is horrified.
We don't talk about our favorite professors on the educational channel of Pornhub or anything.
These guys wanted to sell dildos for the longest time.
What's a dildo?
Well, I mean, we're still trying to work. We're trying to work, Seth, with like some companies for, you know, the Fade to Gray butt plug, which I mean, come on, because it works for the Pentecostal, and you, if you're doing yoga, you know, you don't want the demons to enter into your soul. So like
that's the downward dog. He's saying the sex comment. I'm not understanding this. Why
this was such a beautiful conversation interview.
All right, Omar, your mother and my mother have never bought us sex toys, and we are straight. So I'm not sure why that you're asking Randy that question.
I don't know. I guess that's the inner bigot in me. I'm not sure.
Is that your point? Well, I guess we'll wrap on that. All right. I love you guys.
Seth, get off Grindr and end this thing.
So I appreciate you, Randy. Seriously, it's been a lot of fun. Yes. I mean, you took us to like, you know, a lot of places. You had me like about in tears at one point, and
I was crying.
Seth was crying.
Yeah, I cried a little bit. Randy, I want to thank you so much for this conversation. And through this series, we really want to show multiple perspectives. And I think we did that in this episode. Your vulnerability, your honesty, and your authenticity is very much appreciated. And if people want to get a hold of you, you know, you mentioned email you, call you, that kind of stuff. Like, how would people find out about you? And is there anything in addition to Thrive or that you're doing at Thrive that you would like to promote?
Well, right now, the pandemic has kind of shut down our in-person types of things. I was going to try and do an offline group, but the pandemic just shut everything down. We are doing the town hall a Monday night. I don't have the details yet. I just know it's going to be 7 o'clock Eastern Monday night. So we'll have that link on the Facebook Thrive page, which is facebook.com/ThriveLGBTQ. The second documentary that I'm in, Pray Away, we're still kind of, it was supposed to premiere at Tribeca, and technically it did, but they didn't actually have the festival, but it's going to be released soon as well. And that one has gotten amazing critical review. The first one, For They Know Not What They Do, has as well. So both of those documentaries, For They Know Not What They Do, they can rent on iTunes and Prime. Pray Away, though, it could be a really big deal. There's a
is
lot
it
of,
for yeah. rent on Prime, or is it one of those? Is it
Pray
free
Away
for Prime
isn't yet? For They Know Not What They Do is, I think it's for rent, but it's like $1.99 or $2.99.
Right on.
When Pray Away comes out, like, hit us back up, because we might want to interview you again
that'd
and
be
also
great.
Promote that when that
maybe
hits.
Have you
so
on
just
movies
FYI,
me and do documentaries.
We're nice folks. We want to talk to you again. But thank you so much for coming on. And
will do. No, thank you so much. I really appreciated the conversation. And thank you for highlighting this issue in the series.
No worries.
Awesome.